Morning.
Morning.
Oh, thank you guys for the weekend. It has been wonderful. We close out, and this morning, you guys want to help me? Bob did the variation of it. He did it as we opened up in the last day. You guys to repeat after me. Please, God.
Please, God.
Let us set aside.
Let us set aside.
Everything we think we know.
Everything we think we know.
About ourselves.
About ourselves.
Our disease.
Our disease.
This book.
This book.
This process.
This process.
And you, God.
And you, God.
For an open mind.
For an open mind.
And a new experience.
And a new experience.
Amen. I'm Ralph White and I'm an alcoholic. I wanted to do that because same prayer as Bob, different variations. One of the things that I like to bring to the task, you know, a guy like Bob, just over and over and over, I get the opportunity, and I like Sunday mornings because in L.A., there's a group that usually meets every Sunday morning, and we meet together, and we go through this book. And they add words, and they add lines, and they add phrases. Even though this book, you know, there have been no changes made to the basic text, the first 164, they have not made any changes, but it certainly changes for me, you know. And so I like to approach it all the time with clean slate, see what's in it for me, you know. So I want to thank you guys for the weekend. And we are at page 84. Following the promises, the ninth step promises, it talks about this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. So even though the steps are chronological in their nature, most of the time we say we finish a step before we begin another step. 6 and 7, that what's going on with step 6 and 7 is from the moment I become willing to have the defects removed and ask God to remove them, from that point forward I start a list and I write my 8-step list. And then I start making amends. And the reason why that's important, some people think that the steps of the series are discrete actions. I take one, I finish it, and I move on to the next one. Well, a 6 and 7, I'm never finished. That's an ongoing lifetime process. You know, a discrete act, yeah, you can put a time frame on a 4th and a 5th. You can see when you write it. You can tell when you're finished. You know when you sit down, and you know when you do a 5th step, you know. An 8th and a 9th step. An 8th step is finite, even though you can continue to amass amends and come back. But you know when you do it and you know when you write it. Now, the 9th step, it depends. And it varies for individuals depending on how many amends you have. But the 9th step is also kind of a discrete step. You can see it. It's tangible. You can tell when you complete it. But in order to start the 10th step, I don't wait till I complete the 9th step. As I begin to clean up the past, I begin to do a 10th step. And then in this, I like what this end says. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. I'm always interested. People talk about, when am I going to work my steps? I had a guy call me, and I was talking to him not long ago. He said, I really want to get around to my steps, but I'm so busy, man. I got this new job, you know. We just got a house. And I'm like, what else do you have time to do? You know, the 12 Steps to Alcoholics Anonymous is not an independent activity to the side of the rest of my living. Yeah, let me live life, and then I'll get around to practicing these. It's a lifestyle. It's a new way of living. It's a design for living. You know, it puts it in, it says that a number of different ways. It's an integrate. So we've got to this point, you know. I come from a dark place, you know, and I get beaten to a state of reasonableness by alcohol. You know, never anybody's intention, never want to try to convince anybody to stop drinking. I like when Bob said, if you're still successfully doing it, don't cut yourself 3 years short. Do it to me. We want you when alcohol is through with you. We want you when alcohol is through with you. So I tore my life up. Alcohol had its way with me. I got to a hopeless condition. I got to a point where life was becoming intolerable for me. You know, I got to that self-imposed crisis we talked about, where it was either to be doomed to die, alcoholic death. So then when I was faced with that alternative, and I found some people. I got directed, you know, and I'm one of the people that I don't trip off whether you get here because you coerced, or whether you get here willingly and singing and skipping in Alcoholics Anonymous. I rarely see that. I came in here running from a black truck. That's why I went into recovery. It's not important why you come. What's important to me is why you stay. So I came here and I found out that the reason I couldn't stop was because I was raised wrong. I had good intentions. All my life I said, I know to treat people right, treat people the way you want. I didn't have the power to pull it off. And I didn't have the power to stop drinking. So I got introduced to a power. It's part of my life, part of the way I live. I could not have reentered life without doing that. So then I got introduced to that, and I started. And as a result of getting introduced to that idea that I need this higher power, I made a decision that I'm going to do something about it. I made a decision that since I know I need this power, I better do what it takes to get in touch with that power, get a conscious contact with it so the power can work for me. So we got on our knees, and, you know, as a group, and we take that third step prayer, and I turn my will and life over to this power that I don't know yet. And then I commence to start getting to know the power, start commencing to get in the field and continue to expand on that grace, to crack through all that rubble. You know, I want to expand on it. I want to be a clear channel for receiving it. And I want to expand, and I want to grow my life, because I'm grown and I'm tired of losing. I was 33 years old. I wanted to be a father. I wanted to be welcome in my little girl's life again. I wanted to work for somebody again. I wanted to make a living again. I wanted to be in the land of the living again. I wanted to know Christmas and birthdays. So I started commencing on this way of living. Not studying this book to just go to meetings and talk about it at a podium. I wanted to go back to the land of the living. So I started this process of uncovering, discovering, and discarding the stuff in me that blocks me from grace, blocks me from that sunlight. And that's the way I live my life. I do it because it's the way I live. And I didn't want to guess at how to stay in touch with this power. Once I was able to not get loaded every single day, whenever I met, I liked it, and I wanted to be able to keep that and grow it. And this was the way you said to do it. Look at your life. You know, look at your life. And so there was a process for looking in my life that I didn't have to guess at. And we talked about three inventories. And I do them on a regular basis. And I look at my life and I look at myself and I find out what it is, you know, about me, you know, that keeps me in collision with my fellows. So then I started doing that. And as a result of that and getting rid of some stuff, old ideas, one of my first old ideas was, you don't tell nobody your business. You don't show weakness and you don't show no vulnerability. So I sit in front of somebody and I tell them myself. You know, I share the stuff that holds me in bondage that I'm scared you'll know about me. That if you know it about me, you won't like me. And so I start doing that. And this is all part of Ralph White growing up and coming to life and blood. So I do that. And then it becomes second nature. You don't realize what we do in these rooms. You know, it gets to be second nature, that idea. So where it used to be second nature to never reveal anything. It used to be second nature. You don't tell your business outside the house. You don't tell nobody your business. You don't let anybody in. That becomes a part of my living experience, the guy I'm becoming. And so then I start looking at this other part. There's some stuff in me I don't like about me, and it keeps blocking me from being all that I can be. I call them character defects, you know. And I want to keep growing. I want to get rid of some of that stuff, but I can't get rid of it myself. The car can't fix itself. Send me back to the factory. Told me how to do that. Okay, God, do something with me over here. Because I'm liking the taste of this. I'm liking this new way I'm living. I'm liking the results that I'm getting from it. I'm liking it. I want to keep on. So in my way of living, I'm continuing to say, okay, this stuff is not working. And the way that I get the defects, I don't get rid of them by not practicing them. I get rid of them by continuing to practice them till they don't work anymore. I didn't stop drinking because I stopped drinking. I stopped drinking because I kept drinking. And the same thing with defects. You know, You know, I lie enough till it ain't working, enough till I see it, enough that that is what drives me to want to do something different. You know, and so I get to that point, man, I'm just tired of being this guy, you know. I want to be responsible. I want to have integrity. I want to be able to give my word and keep it, you know. That's how this stuff turns into life stuff, not step six and seven. What does it mean in my life? I want to be a person that you can count on. I want to be a person that's respected, you know. That's how it plays out in my life. We call them six and seven. And so then I do that. And then I want to be able to go anywhere and walk anywhere and not have to worry about the red lights in my rearview mirror, not have to worry about disguising my phone when I answer. Why do you disguise your voice when you answer the phone to a creditor? Like they know you anyway. You know, and you just, you know, creditors calling you, disguising your voice. Like they, you know, what? You know, don't have to be Mr. White's not here anymore. Answer my phone. You know, go where I want to go. Do what I want to do. You know, I like living like that. You know, and that's so now we do this deal. Like looking people in the eye. Like not having to be with one of your boys or somebody you know and kind of cut the interaction short because that loan that hasn't been repaid, it just might crop up. It's just something in between the relationship. We don't talk about it. And the other person may or may not be cool, but I know. It's just something there. So then I get to walk free. And so now I've done that. I've done it. I clean my house. House is clean. You know, went through every room, took the trash out, did a fifth step, did six and seven, and now the house is clean. So what am I going to do now? Am I now going to start not making the bed, stop washing the dishes, letting stuff pile up, let the house in? No. So now I'm going to clean it on a regular basis. When you do so a bunch of cleaning, it's good to try to keep it clean now. You know, sometimes, I don't always do it the best. Bob and I were talking about this yesterday. Just as an aside, I can do regular. We're going to talk about this 10th step. And the 10th step is kind of like an ongoing, regular, daily inventory. You know, and theoretically, if I do it right, I wouldn't do a written inventory anymore, theoretically. Some people say it, and some people live like that. I still do regular inventory because I don't live life. I don't clean up perfectly every single day. Stuff piles up in Ralph's life. That's the kind of guy I am. You know, things still pile up, and over a year and a half, 2 years' time, I'm liable to have some stuff I need to look at in a big way. That's just to the side. So I still, personally, still do regular inventories. But the 10th step is an ongoing way. I've entered into a new way of living now. You know, we have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. That word right there, grow in understanding and effectiveness. Sometimes I have to say, you heard yesterday when we talked about doing inventory, a critical question to ask myself, do I want to be right or do I want to be free? And here's another critical question, depending on the interaction, do I want to be right or do I want to be effective? Do I want to be right or do I want to be effective? Sometime in my home group, I don't take on every battle because do I want to be right or do I want to be effective? I'll lose my voice if I'm taking on every battle. In my personal life, if I'm taking on every battle. With my sponsees, if I'm over controlling this, do I want to be right? And I might be right with what I see, but do I want to be right or do I want to be effective? So my next function is not to grow in knowledge and wisdom. It doesn't say that. It says to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Imagine that. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. It always interests me when people say, I went through the steps and I'm done with my, that always baffles me. Because I just don't understand if you're doing a 10th and 11th and a 12th, you already know it's a continuum. People say, I did my steps, I'm going to do them again. It's a continuum. It's a manner of living that I have now entered into a new way that I'm living. It should continue for a lifetime. Continue. How do I do this 10th step? What is it that I do? continue to watch. Critical word. I have that one highlighted and underlined. Watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. What does that sound like? Where do we find those in the first place? Where? Step four, inventory. Resentment inventory specifically. Continue to watch. Before I wasn't watching for them, I had to go discover them. When I wrote inventory, it was the first time I looked at them and discovered them. Now I've discovered them. I'm in the realm of the spirit now. I'm in an awakened spirit. I have a conscious contact. Now I'm watching. I'm vigilant for that. Watch for. And here's another word. When these crop up, so all of you who think you'll be floating by the time I reach the, when, not if they crop up, when these crop up, I'm human. I hear people a lot of times say, that alcoholic thinking. Some of it is, but some of it is human thinking. You know, we put a lot of stuff on. I'm still sick. No, I'm not. But by this time, there are some things about me that are twisted. There are some things about me that are warped and beyond, straightening out, But I'm human. I'm human. So I don't care. I'm 22 years old. Bob's over 30 years old. We had somebody yesterday that was, we had a couple of people here that raised their hand when he said over 23. It doesn't matter how long I do the deal. I'm human. Stuff crops up. That's why we have these steps right here. Continue to watch for selflessness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Saw that in the inventory. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. What's that still sound like? 6 and 7. When they crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately. 5. And make amends quickly if we have harmed anybody. 9. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. There's our 12th step. Love and tolerance of others is our code. So now, the action of the steps and this process on my life. I come from selfishness, self-centeredness being the root of my problem. I do this activity of 4 through 9, and I come out with the antidote to the selfishness and self-centeredness, or the antithesis of the opposite. Love and tolerance. Love and tolerance is our code. Imagine that. I go into this process selfish, self-centered. That's who I am. And, that's what it is that I go bring to the table. I call it that's the default position. And I apply these steps to my life. I get conscious contact with this power that can do for me what I can. It does something miraculous for me. Love and tolerance is our code. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. What step did we have that word sanity or insanity? Step 2. What does step 2 say? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could do what? Restore us to sanity. And right here we say, for by now, sanity will have returned. Oh, we finally realize that step 2. By now, sanity will have returned. Step 2 is the solution, but it takes that action. When we went through that 4 through 9, actually after making that decision, and then went through, by now, sanity is returned. The result of those steps. We will seldom be interested in. These are some hell of a promises right here in this 10th step too. And Kathy, if you're sitting in day 31, you're in day 31. And this is what I'm looking for. This is what I'm looking for. I didn't know it was possible. I would look at guys sitting up here and I would think. These are the questions that new people offer. Do you ever get to a point where you don't think about alcohol? Think about it. Do you ever get to the point where it just feels like you're not white knuckling this deal? Do you ever get to the point where it feels like you won't be dominated by it? Do you ever get to that point? For by this time, sanity will return. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Here's the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. Don't try to claim that if you knew. Don't try to claim it because it's a 10-step promise. I remember I used to read stuff in the book and then I'd try to claim it as my legacy because I read it. The book says that, you know, I'm not fighting it and I'm not, you know, that's not where I'm at yet. I get there from some effort on my part, but I don't do it. I don't make it happen. I didn't take the taste out of my mouth. God will change me without my permission, but he does need my cooperation. That's the power's job. You know, I hear people say all the time, you know, surprise, it's hard. Living life sometimes feels hard for a guy like me. Staying sober is the easiest thing I've ever done in my life. That's not my job. I wake up in the morning, I have not done nothing to take that taste out of my mouth. He took it out. It's gone. He took it out. I wake up in the morning, I don't say, oh, I'm not drinking today. Took it out. Now, living life for a guy like Ralph, being grown every day gets hard. Feeling like the weight of the world on you someday gets hard. Sometimes this idea of making it on you gets hard. That's why I need a power. You hear people say all the time, you know, God won't give you more than you can handle. And I always say, yeah, but life will. That's why you need God. That's why I need him. You know. But these promises right here. I like my home group used to say a lot of stuff. They used to say, you know, because you'll hear the stories. And they are the success stories in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a new house, and I got a family, and I have a job. And all that is what takes place in here. People recreate their lives. But at bottom, in my home group, what they used to say is, in Alcoholics Anonymous, what we promise you is sobriety. You want a job? Do a resume and go on interviews. You want a car? Save some money and go buy it. You want a family? Be responsible. Become productive, become presentable, and become attractive to somebody, then do it. But what we promise you in here is these promises right here. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. The problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor we are afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. How do I do that? And it's easy to let up on the program of action and rest on our laurels. Why do you think it's easy to let up on it? If I've reaped these benefits after doing all this, why now is it easy to let up? Huh? Life gets good. Well, shouldn't I want to keep doing what made life get good? I take credit. I'm lazy. I forget. No discipline. Hold that thought because we're going to come to your thought in a moment. somebody from their own experience. Get unhappy. There's a nice un with that, but most of the time when I get unhappy, it's preceded because I get ungrateful. Somebody else help me. What else is it? Why is it easy? Or is it easy to let up? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. God works anonymously, just like the program Alcoholics Anonymous. Easy to let up. But we talked about it yesterday, too. Sometimes I get to this point, and I'm cool. I've made it. I breathe a sigh of relief. I put in my time. It's time for new people to start doing what it is that they do. And here's the deal. Here's the curious thing about the way that God works. Because he works so anonymously. And he does his work so well. I start getting some stuff. And pretty soon, if I let up on the spiritual program action, I start letting my blessings separate me from the one who's giving them to me. I get so caught up in maintaining the blessings, I forget to maintain the relationship with the one who gave them to me. So now I got the stuff, and now I got all of this, and now I am at this point where I'm kind of spiritually floating. I'm doing this deal that Bob talked about yesterday. Instead of this ego staying deflated, the gifts of sobriety, they come, and if I'm not careful, they can re-inflate that ego, and I can start walking away from the power without knowing it. And it's easy. Sit around here long enough, and I'll see it happen. It's easy, because I get judgment start creeping back in, and people aren't doing it right. This is not the old AA. It's not the AA I knew about, because I'm up here now. You know, I tasted this spiritual life, and I tasted it, and it seems like the people want. So that's why, you know, I think following these 10, and we'll talk. God's going to talk about 10 and 11 and 12. I am so grateful to have that. So grateful to have. Well, let's talk about it. It's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action. I don't need to keep writing inventory. The spiritual program of action. It's easy to let up on that. I don't have to keep writing inventory. I don't have to keep doing amends. I did them once. I'm not going to see if I owe anybody new ones. I've done all my amends. I've done amends before. I'm not going to check to make sure I don't owe new ones. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action. And the program of action, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It didn't even say it's easy to stop. It's easy to let up on it. I don't need to write anymore. I wrote when I was in my first class. I don't need to do any more writing. I already know myself. It's easy to let up on the spiritual program action and rest on my laurels, rest on my past accomplishments. And on Alcoholics Anonymous, they say, you can't win today's game with yesterday's scores. But I tried to. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle fault. We are not cured of alcoholism. So even though we talked about the problem does not exist for us, don't get it confused, Ralph. We're not cured of alcoholism. That physical thing in me, that physical thing is still in me. Floating like I'm floating. Sponsoring numerous people, haven't had the spiritual awakening, let me take some alcohol in my system. I still suffer from the phenomenon of craving. I am not cured of alcoholism. Did a lot of talking this week about Bob saying it's a chronic disease. Didn't go anywhere. I'm not cured of alcoholism. I have a daily, what I really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Every day is a day when I must carry the vision of God's will in all my activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. So now I got a will alignment. I align my will with God's will. It's the proper use of it.
I'm an alcoholic.
Ralph was talking about something I've thought about a lot over the years. Some of what happens within me looks like alcoholic thinking and feelings, and some of it looks like normal thinking and feelings. What's the difference? And is it what's the deal? And on page 30 in the book, it implies something. It says, not only am I bodily different, which is evident by the phenomenon of craving if I pick up a drink, but it implies that I'm mentally different. And then on page 22, it says something that I misinterpreted the first time I read it. I'll read it. It's an interesting line. It's the first line, the last paragraph. There's no, we know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Does that mean I'm like other people?
Mm-hmm.
Reacts much like, a transvestite's much like a woman. But not really. I mean, not really, really. And what I think it is back to another thing that Ralph talked about. I think that if I'm in fit spiritual condition, what is it that happens to me? Is that I'm not absorbed in myself, in my judgments, in my fears, in my resentments, in my gratification, that I am present, and I'm right here, and I'm thinking about you and not thinking about me. My daughter has become my benchmark for normalcy. She amazes me. She is so other-centered by nature. She didn't have to get a sponsor to be that way. I mean, she just cares about, legitimately cares about people because it makes her feel good. And so she's in that mode all the time. She's very forgiving by nature. When someone does something that hurts her feelings, she gets upset. She might even cry a little bit. And then she says the craziest things that I have to work steps and go to meetings and talk to a sponsor about. She just says them naturally, like, well, I'm sure they didn't mean it and they were doing the best they could. Or something like that. I look at her like, on the natch, she's like that. She does not have alcoholism. I think the difference between me and a normal person, and if I'm to believe that I am bodily and mentally different, and that the best I will ever get is to be much like, which means on a good spiritual hair day, I have a veneer over my alcoholism, and I go out in the world, and I don't feel different, I don't look different, I fit, I have a sense of community I'm part of because I'm out of myself, that my emotions, when I get them, and everybody gets afraid, everybody gets resentful. But well, because my natural default position is self-absorption, I don't just get that way. I drink of it like I drank alcohol. I'm not a social feeler or a social thinker. I get it right here and magnify up. Did you ever have the experience of somebody just says something that's a little unkind, a normal person would go, geez, that hurt my feelings, and just go, that I guess you didn't mean it, and go about their business? Oh, I'm going to think about this for days. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Right. I'm plotting their demise, right? I go to everybody that knows them and to convince the people that know them what a jerk those people were. And not only do I have resentment towards that person, by default, I dislike anybody who likes them. Right? If you're friends with that guy, well, oh, you're an asshole. I mean, you're just, right? Isn't that weird? Now, normal people don't do that. Because they don't get it right here like I get it right here. They don't obsessively focus on their internal stuff like I do. They get the feelings, they get afraid, they get their feelings hurt, all that stuff. But I drink of it like I drank alcohol. It's almost like I can't get enough. Where the book says we're victims of a delusion that we can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world if we only manage well. Most, you know, we have a tendency in Alcoholics Anonymous to talk about running the show out here, but a lot of my management is up in here, right? I got this little control room in my head where I go and I, as if I'm going to think, do you ever get the feeling like if you're afraid of something, something's coming at you, that if you think about it enough, maybe it'll go away or something? And I am bodily and mentally different. And yet, if I keep in reasonably fit spiritual condition, I fit pretty good. I'm very comfortable. But I don't think any of us stay there. That's the problem. You know, all the promises in Alcoholics Anonymous, they kind of come and go. It's one, you know, one day you know a new freedom and a new happiness. The next day you just don't drink. You know what I mean? It's just, right? It's like that because the clamoring of my ego is insistent and it never stops. It never stops. You know, you walk into a meeting and somebody doesn't say hi to you, it just starts. It's like it's that we talked about yesterday, that the character Wormtongue from Two Towers just starts. Right? Just starts. And there I am, I'm back over on the other side again. I'm back into my default position, being the center of the universe, and why are you all screwing with me? And the key word is me. Right? And I've one of the great things that has made me very comfortable is it took me a long time, probably 20 years, is to really gut level in the pit of my stomach accept the chronic nature of this alcoholism. This is me. Not because I'm that make me a bad guy, that I have a propensity to judge and self and ego and all that. It's just me. I think, and I heard a guy say this years ago, and it ties in with something that Father Ed Dowling said. He heard this Catholic priest at a retreat say that he thought alcoholism was God's greatest gift and greatest blessing. And he said, a blessing is something that pushes you, shoves you, or drags you screaming into being more than what you are. And alcoholism, in that sense, is really God's greatest blessing. When you think of the heights of being alive that some of us feel in service in Alcoholics Anonymous and helping others, that amazing, amazing connected feeling we get at moments, even though it may be fleeting, we can recapture it and recapture it and recapture it. It's an amazing thing. How, as we let go of our lives and back away from them, how they evolve according to a plan that is something better than anything we could have imagined. As long as I take my hands off of it. And then the opposite is the minute I get my hands back on it, it starts to turn to crap. You know, it starts to turn brown and stink. The minute I get my hands on it again. And so we back off again. And that seems to be my life for many, many, many years now. Ralph read the line about we've entered the world of the spirit. Another place in the book talks about the realm of the spirit. And there is a solution. Bill talks about being rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. What is this realm of the spirit, this world of the spirit, this fourth dimension? This thing that we're supposed to wake up to. What is it? I asked a guy that I sponsored a guy years ago that was a he taught astronomy and physics and taught science classes at a local school in Las Vegas. And he was a very, very smart guy, educated way beyond his intelligence. He was a very, very bright guy. And I asked him one day, I said, what's the fourth dimension? It sounds science fiction-y. And he said, no, it's not. It's a reality. He said, years ago, it was thought that there were only three dimensions, the dimension of height, width, and depth. And then Einstein and some of his contemporaries started to realize that there was more dimensions. He told me, now they think there's 10, which I can't even get my mind, I have a hard time getting my mind around 4, but he said, they think there's 10. He said, but the fourth dimension that Einstein talked about was time. That existence cannot only be measured by width, depth, and height, but also by time because it's fluid. It moves in a constant ever presence in a linear manner. Right? So all that's real is always the now. So maybe if I'm rocketed into the fourth dimension, I'm pulled out of this thing, which is out of time, and I show up. Alcohol did that for me. I remember it. I remember these amazing experiences where I would walk into a bar and just be so disconnected and isolated and up in my head. And after 5 or 6 drinks, I can hear the music. I mean, really hear the music. It's moving me. After, you know, you can talk, you can enter into a conversation with someone, and you're very present. It's not like when you walked in there, people are talking to you, it's just like, hey, leave me alone. You know, you just nod, you're not even hearing them. You're present. I'm right there with you. I often, in this being rocketed through alcohol into this fourth dimension, to the now, I often had legitimate feelings of care for other people. We all, you know, we have a tendency to bad rap alcohol, but I got to tell you something. I believe that at one time alcohol really induced a spiritual experience because I think at one time it seemed to relieve me of the bondage of self. It would get me off of me and I could be very present. And Alcoholics Anonymous, the end game here is to do that. Is that so I can claim my inheritance, which is this world and is this life. And become conscious of where God is because he's right here, right now. He's not in my head. He's not in the future. He's not in the past. He's right here, right now, right now. This realm of the spirit. I noticed something. My daughter's like this, and my daughter is one of those people that I've seen all my life and didn't understand. They used to aggravate me, and you probably had this experience in grade school, in high school, out in the workforce, and when I was in college, some of the fine better colleges I flunked out of. There's all these people that just seemed effortlessly to reap amazing stuff out of life. It was almost as if everything they touched just clicked. They had great relationships. Everybody loved them. Everything they did turned to gold. It was like as if they were in some sort of zone where everything worked. And the thing that aggravated me is I was smarter than all of them. Right? And my life is turning to crap. And I'm smarter than all of them. What is it? Why are they reaping what they're reaping and I'm reaping all this crap? Because they naturally are free from the bondage of self. They naturally... I had a guy work for me for years. And he was not an alcoholic. He's just a normal guy. He had a legitimate... He loved people legitimately. Legitimately all the time. And even people that were out of line and having bad days, he had concern for them. He'd restored this 19 early 50s Ford, and it was beautiful. It was immaculate. And he had it sitting out in front of one of the store that he managed for me, and a drunken driver came along and creamed it. Now, some of these parts you can't even get. I mean, he'd spent like 8 years restoring this car. It was beautiful. And they creamed it. And I'm more upset than he is. Right? I want to get a gun. Right? You know, he chokes up a little bit. He gets a little upset. He cries a little. He sheds a couple of tears and he goes, man. And then he sighs his sigh and he goes, well, he says, I hate to be that guy when he wakes up in the morning and realizes what happened because the police were arresting him and everything. He went right to thinking about the guy in a loving, concerned manner. I'm looking at him like, will you share whatever medication you're on, share it with me, would you? Because I'm not that way by nature. I may be that way after a phone call to my sponsor and I go and pray and do a bunch of stuff. Then I might be that way. But not just like that. I mean, that's not me. I grew up in a religious background that I got to tell you objectively, I don't know that what I heard when I was a kid in church and in catechism was actually said. I'm suspect of my perception because there are people that were involved in that church that were in the same rooms I was in, and when I heard what I heard, and I don't think they heard what I heard because they're still happy being there. It drove me crazy. I only heard the negative. I heard about a God of judgment. I heard about a God that would punish me for my sins. And that made me nuts because I like sin. I mean, I like a sin. I don't like a lot of it, but I like a little bit of it. Once in a while, for God's sakes, I mean, you've been a good sport up to now, you get a little sin, don't you? I mean, I'm just too bad at being good and too good at being bad. I have to break out and sin every once in a while. I don't mean to, but I have to do it. It's like I can't help it. And I had this fear and separation from God because I thought he was going to punish me for my sins. What I never realized, the great reality, is that God doesn't punish me for my sins and never did. I'm not punished for them. I'm punished by them. By what happens to me as I get out of line with me and life itself. It is inherent in the action. It's not God not doing that. Matter of fact, I think I've done some crap that's made God weep. Like you do for one of your children or a sponsee or somebody you love in your home group that's destroying themselves. You just go, oh man, I bet that hurts. God, I wish he wouldn't do that. Not because it's bad or wrong. I'm awake. I get it. I get what you reap from that. Because I would reap that. I know what I reap. One of the great things about this awakening is not that I've gotten good. By no means. I just get it. I just get what the price of stuff is. You know what I mean? I get it. I mean, I still this alkalogic sometimes where I think, it might be worth it. I reap what I sow. Always did. This code that it talks about on page 84, the code of Alcoholics Anonymous, love and tolerance. Bill Wilson, in a letter one time, said that honesty got us to Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was only tolerance that would keep us here. And tolerance, as a word in the English language, I think is very misunderstood. I misunderstood it. I thought tolerance was to be politely pissed off at someone. You know, like I know you're an asshole, but I'm too big a guy to say anything. You know, that kind of thing, right? I thought that was what tolerance was. I grew up with people that were like that. Well, you just, yeah, they're a jerk. Just don't say anything. That's not tolerance. That's how you build an ulcer. I think real tolerance is something that some of us begin to learn and experience in the fourth step when we do this with our course. When my perception of you, I start to wake up to who you are. And so consequently, I get it. I get the fears and I get the frustrations and I get the pain that has been driving you. Because you know something? In my life, it's driven me too. And as I get you, all of a sudden, my view of you changes. And now I'm not irritated anymore by your actions. I actually have a genuine compassion because, man, you know, I struggle with the same crap. There have been times where I haven't done any better with it than you're doing. And what happens is my perception of you changes. And it allows you to turn freely in your life without irritating me. Tolerances are talked about by mechanics. Often in engines, the tolerance, because of friction, will eventually get off. And then what happens is a mechanic has to take the engine apart and maybe shave parts or adjust things to reset the tolerances so that when the engine's working again, that the parts turn freely of each other without creating friction. Because if they don't do that, the tolerance is off. You'll create so much friction that eventually the engine will blow up. Or I'll blow up at my boss. Or I'll blow up at somebody in AA. Or I'll blow up at the girlfriend or whatever, right? Because it's my I am out of sync. I am out of sync with life itself. I'm back into my default plain God self-centered position again. And recovery from alcoholism is constant readjustment. My sponsor had a great analogy years ago. I haven't heard him use it in 15 years. He said that our lives depend upon being connected to God's grace. And he said that God's grace was like the signal that would go out from a tower for a TV station. It was available to any TV out there. I mean, it doesn't judge. It doesn't withhold. It doesn't do any of that stuff. It's there for, it's right across the board. Equanimity. Absolute. The problem with the alcoholic is that we are receivers. Are like an old beat up TV set with aluminum foil on the antennas, on the kind of TV set you gotta be constantly screwing with the knobs and the antennas to keep the signal in, but we've got our TV sets in the back of a pickup truck on a bumpy road. I mean, so it's like a really, it's just constant readjustment to keep that signal in, keep that signal in. And we all have that experience. I mean, it's like the book says continue to watch for the manifestations of self, which disrupt God's grace, which disrupt my connection with you, which push me back up into here again and playing God, that makes me feel eventually depressed and anxious, and like somebody's crimped the oxygen hose to my being. Once we taste connectedness, everything, lack of it, starts to really become conscious of the feeling of desolation. If you were never connected, the problem is that alcohol spoiled us. It spoiled us because it allowed us an experience that normal people don't get in the contrast that we got it. If you're just normally connected, it's just you don't even know any difference. But what if you're wrapped up and depressed and locked up in your head and you don't fit anywhere, and then you taste the glory of that majestic connectedness that we got when we got high? It spoils you. It spoils you. And those of us that recoup that in sobriety as we connect with God and we connect with people, when you taste that, when you lose it, there's a sadness about it. Sometimes it feels like depression. It's because I lost it. I yearn for it. I yearn for a drink. I yearned for connectedness. I yearned for God. Didn't know it. I used to discount God because I was afraid God, I didn't measure up to Him. So I'm one of those kind of guys, if I think you're not going to like me, I'll not like you first. Right? But inside me, I always, earlier in the book, page 55, it says that the fundamental idea of God was always, the yearning was always in me, deep down within me, always was. I think that's why a lot of us that reject religion and throw God, the baby out with the bathwater, reject God. What happens to us? We become seekers. Seekers of thrills sometimes. See, all the different things that people like us do. I went through a phase where I just went for almost every day to an amusement park with hashish and amyl nitrate roller coasters. Like, as if like I'm trying to light something up inside of me, you know? As time goes on, you get a little more and more bizarre. I mean, trying to get lit up. I mean, but what am I really seeking? Why did I go to meditation classes? And why did I get into sex a lot? And why did I do everything that I was driven to? Because it was a misdirected and misperceived yearning for connectedness. The ego doesn't like that. The ego doesn't want to be a part of. The ego wants to be God unto itself. That's why the ego judges and pushes people away. It don't want to be part of. It wants to be all or nothing. It'd rather be nothing. It'd rather kill you than have you part of. And without this daily stuff and this continuing to watch for this stuff, a guy like me doesn't have much of a chance, really. Doesn't have much of a chance. Because I will always, always naturally revert back into self. And the problem with me is as I take the journey back into self, I justify every step of the way. I've done a study, just unto myself, not formally on paper or anything, but I was a chronic relapser for 7 years. So for over 30 years, I've been going probably an average of twice a week to places where guys who relapse with a lot of time end up. And I go there. And I go there because I believe that if I have what they have, what could happen to them could happen to me. And I don't ever, ever want to go down that road. And I'll tell you why. It's not because it's a bad road or anything. I know that there's no more rope left at the end for me. I am at the end of my rope. I don't have another time back. I don't. I know that. I don't kid myself about that. I don't have the luxury of one more bash. I don't have it. I will die. And I'm not afraid of dying. I'm afraid of dying in that heart-wrenching loneliness and desolation. I'm afraid of crossing over and taking with me feelings of self-loathing. I'm afraid that I will carry a hell beyond anything I can imagine to the other side. I don't want to lock that in with me. That's what I'm afraid of. And so I have everything to lose here. So I try to watch people that relapse. And do you know, this is when ego justifies itself all the way to oblivion. And the reason I know that is that if you see a guy who 3 days before he gets high again, he'll tell you he'll never get high again. They don't know. They don't know the key hasn't turned. All of a sudden, it's a funny thing because relapse involves opportunity and untreated alcoholism together. They have to be together because all of us have had people offer us drinks and all of us have had people offer us drugs. We've all had that. But if we're in fit spiritual condition, it's like, no thanks. But what happens when you're sick in here and you've got resentments and ego's in charge and you're running the universe and you're the judge guy and all of that, and then the opportunity, that meets opportunity. And somewhere inside yourself, you've been yearning for relief and freedom because you're getting tired of being up here. you're getting tired of the isolation. And I think that's how guys like me relax. So I try to do some of this stuff every day. I'm not real good at it. These are the weak areas in my life are step 10 and 11. But I try to be fairly diligent. And one of the things that has happened to me, part of my own awakening, and I think it's we all awaken to this to some degree, as I go through the years inventorying daily, or at least to some degree, some days are real, I'm very good at it, some days I'm not, but to have that as part of my life, what am I inventorying? I'm inventorying manifestations of ego, of self. And why am I doing that? Well, do you know that no one I've ever talked to or ever read about has ever actually eyeball to eyeball saw the ego? Just as I don't know anybody that's ever seen face to face God. What do we see? We see the manifestations of ego and the manifestations of God. I mean, there are people that actually see God face to face, and I don't know when they'll ever get off their meds and get out. I mean, but what in reality, what most of us see and have become conscious of is His presence by a manifestation, either in our hearts or in our lives. I mean, you can see the hand of God. I mean, it doesn't. You don't have to be in AA doing this deal very long before you start to see. You get overwhelmed by coincidences, you know, and you start seeing it. And you can learn something about the Creator by its creation. There are songwriters and there are novelists that I've never met, but I'll tell you, I've read and I've looked at everything they've ever created I could get my hands on. And I got to tell you something, I've never met them, but I feel like I know them. I'm very familiar with the Creator through its creation. And I think part of the awakening process is I start to become awake of how my ego works in my life so I can be diligent and continue to watch for it and do the constant corrections back into spirit and out of self. And also to an ever ongoing awakening to the presence of God in my life and how very fortunate I am that I've been wrong about God. See, God's in my life to a degree that years ago I would have told you wasn't possible because I don't deserve it. I am so delighted to be wrong about needing to deserve God. I'm so delighted about that. All I have to do is keep turning to the light, whether it's a bad day or a good day. I can turn to the light in the middle of a day when I just did something that I'm not real happy about, like I was in a restaurant and it didn't wait on me quick enough and I hadn't eaten anything all day and I was a little agitated. And so I read the waitress the riot act and embarrass myself and act like a 3-year-old kid having a temper tantrum and storm out there. The restaurant, now there's another place I can't go back to. That in the midst of that, when I feel like I don't deserve, after I've treated one of God's kids like crap, in the midst of that, I can turn towards the light. And out of the light, I will get the intuitive thought of how to go back into that restaurant and say, I am sorry. I was out of line. You did not deserve that treatment. Is there anything I can do to make it right? And sometimes, you've ever done that? You've ever had that experience? It's amazing. You'll brighten up somebody else's day. Now here's a waitress. You're the fifth person that's given her a hard time, but you're the only one for maybe months and months that ever came back and said they were sorry. Amazing. Amazing experience. Let's take a 8-minute and 23-second break.